Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today, I'm very excited to have Charles Petzold, who is a living legend and an icon in our industry. Charles has been writing books and articles about Microsoft-based operating systems since 1984. He's currently part of Xamarin documentation team, and since Xamarin acquired Microsoft, that means he's a Microsoft employee. Charles, how are you?
Good, good. Was that a Freudian slip of Xamarin acquiring Microsoft?
No. That's how I say it. Okay. That's how I think of it.
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
And great.
Very pleased to have you here. Like everybody else, I learned Windows 3.1 from your book and have been reading them all ever since.
Okay.
And your latest book in terms of Microsoft and Xamarin is the Xamarin Forms book.
Yeah, Creating Mobile Apps with Xamarin Forms, which is it's a free book. You can download it from the Xamarin website. And Xamarin still has its own website at this point, even 6 months after the acquisition.
And is that book complete now, or is that an ongoing project?
It's complete as of what Xamarin Forms was like when the book was completed. there's been a bunch of new stuff being introduced in Xamarin Forms, and the book doesn't cover that. And we've been kind of tossing around ideas about how to cover that stuff in the book, or whether we should be revising the individual chapters in the book or doing a full upheaval and making a second edition. We don't know yet. It's still being discussed. But one of my coworkers, David Rich, has been doing a lot of good online documentation of the new Xamarin Forms features. So it doesn't seem as if there's a real need to do a book treatment of those features, since he's been doing such a good job with the online documentation.
Yes, his material is extremely valuable, and James Montemagno has been keeping folks up to date on some of the Xamarin Forms and some of the other Xamarin improvements as they've been coming. Before I talk to you about the new material in Xamarin Forms, I wanted to ask about your book. I know that it's free as a download, as a PDF. Is it still available in paperback, or that's long gone?
I'm not sure. There were printings made, and there was a distribution at the Xamarin events, and also at Build. I haven't checked recently whether it's a print copies are still available. I assume they are not.
Okay, fair enough. We'll download, and that's in PDF form, or is there also a Kindle form?
It's you're asking me the really tough question today.
Well, we'll put a link on the page to where it is.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about where Xamarin Forms are going. If someone has been working in Xamarin Forms and coming up fairly recently, are there a lot of new things to know?
There are several new features that allow you to more easily do platform-specific stuff. Sometimes Xamarin Forms itself is a uniform API that if you stick to that API, you can compile your app for Android or iOS or Universal Windows Platform. But there's also there's a facility that if you want to add new controls to Xamarin Forms, you can do that. And it's a rather involved process because you have to write what are called renderers in each of the three platforms that attach to the native control. But recently, in the past several months or so, there's been a couple new features that allow you to get at native features without the hassle of writing a renderers. One of these is called Native Views, and I discussed it in an article, a special issue of MSDN Magazine that was published in connection with Connect late last year. If you go to searching for MSDN Magazine online, you'll find that issue and the article. And this allows you, even in XAML, to access and put it right into your page native controls from iOS or Android or Windows Phone. And this is a really interesting feature. It's very curious the way it's done, and it can be very powerful. But what you, one of the things you find out when you start doing this, because of course you want to instantiate these native controls right in XAML, is that the Android and iOS did not design their controls to be easily used in XAML, because in XAML you want everything exposed as properties, and that's not the case. So generally you find yourself wrapping an Android or an iOS view, as they're called, with a little bit of code that exposes stuff as properties, and then you can instantiate that right in your XAML file. Recently I've been looking at another feature called effects, which basically allow you to add features to existing Xamarin Forms controls by accessing native features. And this requires writing some code for Android, specific code for Android and iOS and Windows, but it's not as involved as doing whole renderers. I've been recently working on doing some low-level touch processing so that in a Xamarin Forms app, you can track individual fingers. And this is not exposed in the Xamarin Forms gesture recognizers. But I'm seeing that I can do this entirely using the effects feature of Xamarin Forms. And I've been working on that for a little while and hope to get something online within a week or so.
I think one of the questions that a lot of Xamarin programmers have is, when do you reach the limit of effects and you need to turn to custom renderers?
Yeah, it's I think that question is, it can only be answered on an individual basis. But if you can do something in effects that adds features to an existing control, then that's definitely the way to go.
I've been working with trying to drop native controls into Xamarin Forms applications.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm finding is that it's an extremely powerful feature, but frankly, at least as far as I can see, the documentation on this one particular part hasn't really kept up with what it takes to do this. Do you see more documentation coming, or am I just missing what's already out there?
If you would like to see more, we respond to requests like that. Sure.
Well, this was a good time for me to ask then.
Yeah. So,
now, I'm going to switch subjects for a bit. We can come back to Xamarin Forms, but I understand that on your days off, you're working on a new book. Is that, do I have that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What people didn't realize back about, the Annotated Turing was published, almost about 9 years ago, that the Annotated Turing I conceived at the time as being the first of several books that would explore the origins of computing. And I thought of these books as going backwards in time. The Annotated Turing, which is basically about a paper on computability that Alan Turing wrote in 1935 and 1936, that's going to be historically the most recent event that I want to explore. And the next book goes back to the 19th century and analog computing. And this book that I'm working on now is about a tide predicting machine that was created by the Scottish scientist William Thomson, who is better known to posterity as Lord Kelvin. I tend to refer to him as William Thomson because he was William Thomson for most of his life, and when he was doing all this work, and he only became Lord Kelvin towards the end of his life, it was kind of like a lifetime achievement award. And so when you're talking historically about the scientist who's actually doing the work, William Thomson, the name William Thomson makes more sense. But in the 1860s and 1870s, William Thomson got involved trying to analyze the tides and come up with a machine or come up with math that would that describes the tides, and then implemented this in a machine that there is one on display in the Science Museum in the South Kensington area of London. It's a beautiful piece of hardware. It's made out of brass and wood, and has a bunch of little round dials and a roll of paper and a crank there. And the idea is that when you turn this crank, these little wheels bob up and down, and What's plotted out on the paper is the rise and fall of the tides for a particular port for the future. And I first saw this, a picture of this machine, when I was researching code, my book Code, which was about 20 years ago now. And I saw this in a book called Computers Before Computing, a book by William Asprey, which is just a fascinating book of these weird machines and other tools that were used to assist computing long before digital computers became feasible. And I saw this picture of this thing. I just, how does it work? What does it do? And started exploring it over the years. And what I found out is that there is an interesting story connected with this tide predicting machine that has not been discussed in the histories of 19th century science or the biographies of William Thomson or the histories of pre-computer machines. And it's a story that I want to tell in a book. The tentative title of this book is called is Computer of the Tides, Lord Kelvin's Machine to Disprove Evolution. And because one of the purposes of William Thomson's exploration into the tides and building this machine was to essentially to demonstrate that the world was not old enough for evolution to have occurred by means of natural selection, as described by Darwin. And so this is an interesting story to me. And this is the book that I'm working on.
Well, it sounds amazing. Sounds like it's filled with really interesting insights into what happened with mechanical computing machines. Where does the difference engine fit into all of this?
Yeah, Babbage's difference engine was a couple decades before this. So historically, there was most of the stuff done until the 1930s and even beyond the 1930s was analog computers. This tide predicting machine is an example of a special purpose analog computer. And actually, all analog computers are special purpose. There is no such thing in the analog computing world such as the Turing complete or Turing equivalents. We know from Turing's work that all digital computers are basically the same. They can solve the same problems and only solve those problems. Whereas analog computers are always special purpose machines. So what Babbage did with the difference engine and later the analytical engine, neither of which he was able to complete, and this was early in the century, about 1830s, 1840s, that's really an anomaly in the history of this stuff. And it's not surprising that he wasn't able to complete it. It was a little too early for the technology that was available. And but it's interesting regardless. After I said I was going to, I have several books in mind to go progressively back in time. After Computer of the Tides, I would like to do a book that involves Charles Babbage and his machine. But that's for the future.
Let me ask you a little bit about Turing as someone who knows a great deal about him. There's a excellent book and a pretty good movie that touch on his life. The movie is The Imitation Game, and the book that I'm thinking of is Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson. Are you familiar with them, and how close to reality are they?
Yeah, I have not read Neal Stephenson's book, I'm afraid. It's been on my shelf for a while, you know, taunting me, begging me to read it. The movie I was not real happy about, and I wrote a couple of blog entries about it, and I referenced in one of them a very good article in the New York Review of Books about the movie that pointed out a large number of inaccuracies. The movie was highly fictionalized. And I also thought that the character of Alan Turing was unfamiliar with the Turing that I felt I knew from reading biographies and firsthand remembrances of him. There is a possibility that Turing was somewhere on the autism spectrum, but the portrayal in the movie I thought, pushed him far to one end of it, where historically he simply does not belong.
Okay, fair enough. And we see that a lot with fictionalizations of, I want to say, people like Turing, with geniuses who are not contemporary. And so it's not surprising that that a lot of this was compressed and fictionalized and made more dramatic. But he's inherently dramatic. His life and his work is inherently of interest and has its own excitement?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. It's what he did during the Second World War as part of a team to crack the Enigma code is certainly fascinating work. It's just the drama that came out of it, though, was more long term and a result of a day by day grind of trying to analyze these messages and trying to decode them. And the idea that there's a big breakthrough, of course, is common in Hollywood portrayals of anything like that. And it's just not the way it happened. And his later run-in with the law as the punishment under the law, under the conviction for gross indecency adds certainly a lot of drama and a lot of contemporary relevance for Turing. There's recently passed a Turing law that in Great Britain that gave pardons to all the men who were arrested during that era under this law that was basically a law against homosexuality in England.
Yes, he got caught up in a particular time and place, but a lot of his contributions, I think, transcend that.
Oh, yeah.
Let me change directions on you slightly and ask you to talk a little bit about your upcoming book. And I believe that there's a free chapter, first chapter available. So maybe you can tell me a bit more about that.
I have been working on Computer of the Tides for a good 10 years, longer than that. There was a year where I didn't have much other work to do, and I spent several months writing a couple chapters, and I was very unhappy with those chapters. And I basically abandoned them and now working from scratch on it. One thing I want to do in this book is present the whole story without a lot of overt math. Every author who's read Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time remembers in the introduction that he says that somebody told him that every mathematical formula that he put in the pages of A Brief History on Time would cut his readership in half. So he ended up only putting one formula, one piece of math in there, which was E equals MC squared. And this has, obviously, you can't write a book about Alan Turing's paper on computability without a whole lot of math. And the annotated Turing is drenched in math. But for this book, I wanted to try something different. I wanted to try to tell the story without math. And that's a little difficult because this machine is built upon Fourier analysis. The way this tide predicting machine works is you measure the rise and fall of the tides like every hour for a year or 2 years or 3 years. And then you perform a lot of Fourier analysis on it and you break it down into sine wave components. And then you you reconstruct those sine waves in the tide predicting machine and sum them all up. And that's what plots out for the future tides. And my challenge in this book is to tell this story without using math, but with using diagrams, illustrations, and trying that if most everybody encounters trigonometry and sine curves in high school, I guess kids still learn that stuff, right? I hope so.
As far as I know, yes, they're still teaching that.
But adults may be a little weak on it and or may have blocked it all out. I'd like this book to be accessible to reasonably intelligent adults who may be a little math phobic. This has been one of my challenges. And I've also decided to release a draft preview of the first chapter out into the public. This is a chapter I was working on in my so-called free time during most of last year. I took a little writing retreat early in the year and did nothing but work on the chapter and get some feedback from other writers. And over the Christmas New Year vacation, I took 2 weeks off and got the chapter to shape and posted chapter one on my blog. If you go to my website at charlespetzold.com and go to my blog, the most recent blog entry has the first chapter of Computer of the Tides. And I am very curious to see what people think about it.
Well, we'll definitely put a link on the show page for this, but if they want to give feedback, what's the best way to do that?
Oh, just an email. The email address is actually in the introduction to the chapter.
Great, great. Now, we haven't talked about the second part of the title, which is Lord Kelvin's Machine to Disprove Evolution. How does that tie in?
Oh, that's the one of the reasons why I'm devoting a whole book to this one particular machine, is because there's a lot of different pieces that have to fall into place before the mechanics of this machine become evident and before the rationale for the machine becomes evident. The first chapter is the astronomy that's in the background of it. How does the sun and moon affect the waters of the earth? How are tides created? And this was a big mystery for centuries. People knew about the tides for a couple thousand years. Anybody who lives near a seashore can't help but avoid noticing that the water comes up and goes back down twice a day, roughly. In the 17th century, there were a couple of erroneous theories of the tides. One of them was from Descartes, René Descartes. Another was Galileo. Galileo used the tides as a proof of the heliocentric theory of the solar system. Galileo thought that the tides resulted from the interaction of the Earth revolving on its axis, rotating on its axis and revolving around the sun. And twice a day, the surface of the Earth changes direction because part of the day, the surface of the Earth is, half the Earth is going in the same direction as the revolution around the sun, and half the day is going in the opposite direction. And it's going back and forth like this. And to Galileo, this caused the tides. And this was Galileo's sole proof that the Earth rotated on its axis and revolved around the sun. And it's completely wrong. Francis Bacon, who did so much to establish the idea of induction in science, also had a completely wrong theory of the tides. Descartes had a completely wrong theory of pretty much everything. And it wasn't until Newton that it was finally established that it's the interaction of the gravitational attraction of the Earth, of the moon and the sun over the waters of the Earth. And even then, it's not clear how this works exactly. So the chapter one basically tells that story. So that's the astronomical part. The mathematical part, the whole Fourier series, comes about in chapter two, which I am working on now. And that involves Laplace, Pierre-Simon Laplace, and also Joseph Fourier. And both these guys, Fourier particularly, was involved in the French Revolution. He was arrested and almost beheaded at one point, which would have been a great loss. This Fourier established, of course, the Fourier series and the idea that any continuous function can be expressed as a sum of sine curves, which plays a really important role in the tide predicting machine. Now, the big question, why did William Thomson become interested in the tides? And if you read biographies of William Thomson, there was a massive biography, a wonderful academic biography, like 800 pages long, that was published maybe about 15 years ago by two Thomson scholars. And the tide predicting machine shows up in a couple pages of that, but it's completely divorced from anything else William Thomson was doing. And it's just wrong. And it's part of the story I'm telling in this book to show how this tide predicting machine relates to other stuff that William Thompson did. And there's two things, intellectual trends, scientific trends that kind of coalesced at this period. One of them was thermodynamics. William Thompson did most of his major work in thermodynamics, and around 1852, William Thompson established what we know today as the first two laws of thermodynamics. And the first one is that energy is conserved. You can neither create nor destroy energy. You can only transfer it from one type of energy to another. This law became a little amended with Einstein, but it's for non-atomic processes, it's basically true. The second law of thermodynamics is that entropy increases. And what happens is that whenever there is a transfer of one type of energy into another type of energy, heat is created. And heat is unrecoverable energy. You cannot directly convert heat into other forms of energy. The only way that heat can be converted into other forms of energy is if you have a heat differential. If you use two things of different temperature, then you can create energy from that. If you just have one thing of a single temperature, you cannot convert that heat to another form of energy. And that's basically what entropy is, that energy tends to become heat, and then heat is useless. Heat is the cosmic garbage dump of energy. And eventually that leads to what's called heat death of the universe, when the energy of the universe runs down and all you're left with is an entire universe of uniform heat and nothing. It's just dead. All right. So that's one trend, and that's William Thompson. Now, prior to that, there was another revolution going on in geology, starting about, let's say, 1750, and getting more towards the end of the 1700s, geologists started to figure out that the Earth was a lot older than what had previously been assumed. That instead of being thousands of years old, it was more likely millions or billions of years old. And this revolution began around 1750 or so with Buffon, and involved a number of British geologists. And eventually, in the late 1820s, early 1830s, Charles Lyell started writing this big book, published in three volumes, called Principles of Geology. And this book was extremely popular, and it really established for scientists and also for the reading public the idea that the Earth was extremely old. And it was actually Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology that gave Charles Darwin the permission to think in long periods of time, because this is what natural selection required, very long periods of time for living things to evolve. Now, once people started talking about the Earth being very old, then other people started thinking about perhaps the Earth is infinitely old. And this was considered a rather atheistic thought, because if the Earth is infinitely old, then it wasn't actually created. But once William Thompson established the first two laws of thermodynamics, he was one of the first people to really understand the cosmological implications of thermodynamics, that eventually the Earth will run down. Moreover, the Earth cannot be infinitely old because it would have run down by now. So to William, now we've amended some of this stuff over the 20th century, but in the context of the 19th century, this was crucial that to William Thompson, thermodynamics implied that the Earth had a beginning, that it at some point it did not exist, or it existed in a far different form. Now, they knew from mining that the further down you dig, the warmer it gets. From that, you can extrapolate that the Earth is a cooling sphere. And so Thompson also, not the first person, but the first person to really get into it seriously, decided to use physics, his physics and some his physics, to determine how old the Earth actually was. If you think of the Earth as a cooling sphere, and that's where much of the heat of the Earth comes from, inside the Earth rather than the sun. The sun provides some heat, but most of the heat from the that we experience comes from the interior of the Earth. And Fourier had developed the Fourier series while investigating the physics of cooling bodies, so that William Thomson could use Fourier's mathematics, he could use his concept, and actually determine how old the Earth, how long it's been since the Earth became habitable for living things. And he did these calculations over the years, and he found about 100 million years, I think about average. He also investigated how the physics of the sun. And if you think of the sun as burning chemicals, which they were forced to do in the 19th century, then the sun doesn't last long at all. It's like a few million years and it burns out. And they knew that was not the case. They knew that the sun was around for a while and it was not decreasing in intensity. So there were all these, Dwayne Thompson came up with this theory of meteors going into the sun to constantly replenish the burning. But he primarily, William Thompson, this whole idea of measuring the Earth, the age of the Earth, became much more urgent after Charles Darwin published Origin of Species in 1859. Which was at the time a controversial, and it was a just lot slightly. A lot of scientists didn't care for the idea that this process of evolution was happening basically through chance of little variations in offspring could give some offspring a favorable advantage over others and hence pass on those characteristics. Some scientists would have preferred a theory that was more guided from some supreme being. And William Thompson was one of these scientists who did not particularly care for natural selection as described by Darwin. It offended him. And so part of the reason that he pursued these investigations into the age of the Earth was to demonstrate that the Earth was not old enough for natural selection to occur. And this became known. This is now known as the Age of the Earth controversy. And it was one of the major scientific controversies in 19th century British science. And it was only really resolved when it was discovered that there are elements, radioactive elements inside the Earth, such as radium, that generate heat when they're decaying and throw all the other calculations off. But at the time, what William Thompson was the most renowned British scientist of his age. This is the reason why he was the first scientist to become a member of the House of Lords when he was very old. He was recognized for this. And he was doing this hard, what was apparently hard science, showing that the Earth was not old enough for natural selection to occur. And it really disturbed a lot of, it's disturbed Darwin, it disturbed Thomas H. Huxley. They didn't have an answer for it. But they knew, of course, they knew that evolution had occurred. So the Earth must have been old enough. So there must be something wrong with William Thompson's calculations. But we still haven't come to the tides, have we? So this is the story. This is how these pieces of the story. So the way I'm conceiving Computer of the Tides is that chapter one is about the astronomy. Chapter two is about the mathematics, the Fourier series, also about cooling bodies. Chapter three is about the geological revolution, where people's ideas of the age of the Earth started out being Not that everybody believed in the story of Genesis as it's described in the Bible, but that they thought that the Earth was relatively young and how the Earth became very, very old. And then chapter four is on thermodynamics and the conflict between Thompson's idea of entropy and the implications of Thompson's idea of entropy for the age of the Earth and how there was this clash.